A year or two ago, I was asked to give a sermon on embryonic stem cell research. And since then, that's a talk I can't really reuse very much because as science has advanced, it's not as much of a problem anymore. We can use, we can get embryonic stem cells from various things that do not result in the death of what I will call an unborn child. We do, however, still have a problem ever since 1973 in a court case called Roe versus Wade, where we do have the death of unborn children. And I think it's unfortunate that there might be even people, maybe even in this congregation or in the church, definitely, that might consider this sermon to be a political speech. And I think that's very unfortunate because that's the last thing I want this to be. This is not going to be a political speech at all. What I want it to be is to look into the scriptures and to view what might be God's 2 cents worth, which is much more valuable than our 2 cents worth. There have been, since 1973, almost 50 million deaths. 50 million. And we have a problem in our society these last couple years with people not really understanding what numbers even mean, right? And we have congressmen that really get confused on millions, billions, trillions, what the difference is between those. We have billion-dollar bailouts. We have trillion-dollar deficits. And what are those numbers? What do those numbers mean? They're very confusing sometimes. And so to put this in perspective, because I think we need to put this in perspective because we're talking about life here, 50 million lives, that's a little over 16% of the current U.S. population. A little over 16% of the current U.S. population has been extinguished since 1973. 50 million people, my wife's age and younger, are not here. What does God think about this? And this question always really comes down to, and has been since 1973. In fact, if you read the court case decision in that, there's a lot of talk in the court case that says if we discover that, you know, when there is unique human being life, then this might have to be changed. And clearly, science, as most of you know now, and you can just ask Teresa, I'm pretty sure she feels that there's probably life existing right now, which she would like to actually hold outside of the body, I'm sure. Science has clearly proven when it is a unique human being. We have scientific proof on this, and I'm not going to go through the scientific proof on this. I want to just have this be a scriptural lesson. I want to see what God has to say on these things. But the debate has always been when does life start or when does life begin? And there are a lot of people that have the view of that happening at birth, when the child comes out and we can see it for what it really is, and that is when life begins. And that, a lot of times the passage that's used for that is Genesis chapter 2, verses 7. If you want to follow along, you can. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. And it says, the Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And so this verse is used that especially in light of the phrase of the breath of life and the man became a living being, that when the baby takes the first breath of life on his own or her own, that baby is now a living being. But the problem is, of course, is that this scripture that people want to try to use for that isn't anything about birth, is it? This is not a passage on someone being born. This is a passage on what? Someone being created, life being created, right? So this does answer the question on when did life begin. But it doesn't really answer the question on when does new life begin. Clearly, we have man being created here, and it says that, mankind became alive. What was it before? Was it life in the form of some other kind of cells? No, it was dirt. Right? It was dirt, dust to the ground. And God took that and breathed into it life, and man became a living being or a living soul. So we have an example here of when life started, and life has continued on ever since. God's plan of this life and the continuation of this life was put into place. And, of course, soon as God created life, must knowing a little bit about us, He created laws to protect that life, didn't he? Created laws to protect that life. And if we go to Exodus chapter 21, and of course we're well aware that this is part of the old law, under Judaism, but as we know, most of these laws are timeless. God doesn't change. He sometimes changes His will for us on different things, the way He wants us to do from the Old Testament and New Testament. But there are many things in the Old Law that, of course, are always carried on. God doesn't all of a sudden decide that it's okay to kill people. These are laws that have always existed. And most of our laws in our country were supposed to be based on those. And whenever we kind of get away from God's law and we have man's law, we seem to get in trouble. In Exodus chapter 21 and verse 22 through 23, it says, "If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life." And this is God's words here. I want to make clear, everybody understands that this is what God has said. This isn't my thought on it or your thoughts on it. This is what God has said here. And it's sometimes we just kind of read through these things and we kind of get lost on there. This is a pregnant woman. So this is a child that is in the womb. And God says that if this woman is injured so that she loses this child, that it's supposed to be life for what? Life. That's the word God used. God referred to this child as life. And God says that there needs to be a life taken for that life. And as a side note on this, I think that the point there is that God considers that before birth there is life. And it is sacred. And there needs to be laws surrounding the protection of that life. This is what God clearly did and set up for us. But sometimes I see some people that are considered to be pro-life struggle with understanding their beliefs or what they feel is to happen. And people get into a bind and they don't know how to answer sometimes. And so they say, well, you're pro-life, so obviously you're against the death penalty, right? And people get confused on how to answer that. But God is very clear on this, that God is referring the taking of a life for a life. Now, what's the difference between those two lives? What's the difference between those two lives? One is innocent and one is guilty. And this is the difference between those. There's no contradiction between capital punishment and being pro-life. They're really the same. God specifies this in His law. He's very clear about this. That there is the guilty life is taken for that innocent life. And this is the way a lot of things have happened in God's law. And that's what makes the sacrifice of Jesus so amazing. Because what happened for that? An innocent life was given for the guilty. That's what's so amazing and fascinating about God's plan with His Son. It's reversed. An innocent life was given willingly for the guilty. But here in this law, God says that this guilty is to be taken for this innocent. And this is God's law here. So, where does the new life begin? We have some other passages that I'd like to look at. And if we go to the Psalm 139, Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. There's three passages I want to look at. One's in Psalms, one in Jeremiah, and one in Job. And they're all very, very similar, and they are all extremely wonderful. Psalm 139, this is David, King David, speaking. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. That's King David saying, I was David before I was David. I was David in my mother's womb. You were there with me, knitting me together, preparing me for what I was to do. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. And this is the Lord speaking to Jeremiah. It says, the word of the Lord came to me, that's Jeremiah, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. And this is a fascinating verse to me because the first phrase is even, there's a lot more discussion we could have on that. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. This is before he's even formed in the womb. But then it says, before you were born, while you were in the womb, I set you apart for the purpose that I wanted you to have. This is what God is saying to Jeremiah. I knew you before you were born, and I had a purpose for you before you were born. We go to Job chapter 10, verse 8 through 12. Job chapter 10, verse 8 through 12. You remember the story of Job, right? He didn't sin, but his friends and his wife were telling him to curse God. You must have done something wrong. God is destroying you. And Job says in chapter 10, verse 8 through 12, your hands shaped me and made me. Will you now turn and destroy me? Now, we understand the context of that, but you can almost think of another context there, can't you? Your hands shaped me and made me. Will you now turn and destroy me? Remember that you molded me like clay. Will you now turn me to dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You gave me life and showed me kindness, and in your providence watched over my spirit. I think God's fairly clear throughout his scriptures on what his view is, on whether there is life before the physical birth or not. And if you remember the last time we did a little biology lesson, I won't draw anything. I don't want to erase Kelly's quotes and things. But we all have DNA. And the DNA is divided up into 46 chromosomes that is in every single one of your cells. Right? Who should you thank for those chromosomes? We should thank God for allowing my mother to give me 23 of them, and my father to give me 23 of them. Right? Every one of you here has 46 chromosomes in every single cell. 23 came from your mother, and 23 came from your father. And they're a little bit different random than your brothers and sisters. Right? Except for Mike Warner. Okay? And those cells that are in you can duplicate, and we can make more and more cells. We have cells that die. Hair cells sometimes die. Skin cells can die. And we replace them. They can duplicate them through a process called mitosis, right? And all my high school students in here. Mitosis. And we can have new cells with same 46 chromosomes in them. And every cell in your body, almost, has 46 chromosomes in them. Some of your cells, though, only have 23. And that's a process called meiosis, where you make these, what we call the sex cells, that only have 23 chromosomes in them, kind of randomly from your 46. And in males, those are called sperm, and in females, those are eggs. And so if one of those cells comes together with another, if one of those sperm cells that only has 23 comes together with an egg cell that only has 23, and they come together, they form a new cell that has how many? 46. So is it exactly like you? No, it's not. It is a new flesh. It is a new, unique being. Science tells us this. That at that point, we have a new, unique human life. When that happens, when those two cells come together. And then what happens to those cells? They start multiplying again through mitosis. And so there's one cell that has 46, and then there's two cells that has 46, and then there's four, and that keeps going till you get to like the 100 trillion, throw out the number there for you, 100 trillion cells that you have in your body. So where along that line from that first cell to the second cell, two cells or the four cells or the eight cells or the 16 cells, and keep doing that. It doesn't take very long before you can get to your 100 trillion. Where along on that process is it not a human life? You have to make an arbitrary decision. A certain number of cells is where it's the end. And it becomes alive. Somewhere along there it has to be. Now we can try to put some things on it on talking about heartbeats and when certain things are formed or when we speculate that it would feel pain or all these different things on what we're going to try to divide. But all it comes down to is a spectrum from the first cell to your 100 trillion that you have. It's somewhere along that line that we would have to decide that it is not a life. If we go back to Genesis chapter 2 verses 24... I think God helps us out with this long before the science ever agreed with him. Genesis chapter 2, verses 24. And I really like this verse. There's a lot of verses in the Bible that you can look at that has a whole bunch of really good meanings, and they all coincide with each other. They're not contradictory with each other. And some of these are confusing, especially with this verse, because in the New Testament, we read this verse again, and we're told that it's talking about the church in the New Testament. It says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." They will become one flesh. Well, what does that mean? Well, there's a lot of things I think we could think that that does mean. If you look right before that, it talks about that man said, referring to Eve, his wife, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." We're already part of one flesh, right? Woman was created from man. So we're having that reference there, and then we talk about that they will come together and be one flesh. So we have a reference there. Clearly, we have a reference to this being marriage, right? Clearly, it's a reference to being marriage. We know that Jesus is talking about this in the New Testament, and says what man has put together, or what God has put together, that not man put asunder. And he's in that reference, he's talking about divorce. So we know that that's a reference here. We're talking about marriage. I think it's very clear that we're talking about the sexual act, the act of sex that God has given man and woman in the confines of marriage to be one flesh. Man and woman were created to fit together. This was God's plan. And they come together, they are together, and in an idea, they are one flesh. But I think it's not too much of a jump to take this verse literally. Put a literal translation on this. Man and woman leave their father, they come together to form one flesh. This is exactly how now we understand science says it happens. You have cells that's half of you. And your wife has cells that are half of her. And they come together, literally, to make one new, unique flesh. One new human being. And I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying that this verse is only that, and that if you don't have children, you're not married. That's completely unscriptural. We can find a lot of examples of women that maybe were granted to have children later by God, but at the time were not. They were barren, right? It's amazing how many examples there are of that. That eventually they prayed and they eventually might have had children, but you know, maybe there's probably a whole bunch that didn't. Does that mean they're not married? No, it does not mean they're not married. There's clearly other reasons for marriage. Paul in the New Testament specifically says one of the reasons for marriage is so that you don't burn because of the fornication, the temptation that you might have to remain unmarried. Because sex is supposed to be in the confines of marriage. And so that's another reason to be married. But I think it's not a big jump at all when we look at this verse here to refer to that becoming one flesh. You know, since that's literally the way it happens, I think it's a really good interpretation of this particular verse. And why? Why did God set this up? Why did God want man and woman to come together and have this to become one flesh? Remember right after this, what does God say? God gives them a command, and the command is to reproduce and to raise up offspring. Why did God want this? What kind of offspring does God want? Malachi chapter 2, verse 15. Malachi 2:15. Has not the Lord made them one? We have a reference again here. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit they are His. And why one? Because He was seeking godly offspring. He was seeking godly offspring. This is what we are supposed to do with our children. We are blessed with our children. We have one goal, and that is to present them to God. Raise them up as godly offspring to Him. This is what we are to do. That was where I was going to stop. I just, one more thing I just thought I'd throw out here a little bit that we probably, that some people might ask questions later, so I just thought we'd throw this out. And this is kind of, and I'll admit, to me, when we're talking about this issue, I feel that there are not really any gray areas. I think it's pretty obvious on some things. But I could, if you want, I could give you one little, somewhat kind of a gray area that's a little bit difficult to think about, and that is when we're dealing with birth control. And the problem is with birth control is that as long as we're separate, keeping the sperm and the egg separated, then I guess I'm not having a real problem with that. But what happens if they come together and then that new fertilized human being is done away with? And so this is kind of an issue because even on things such as just the regular pill, if you read about these things, then generally the way that works is that it keeps the sperm and the egg separated. They don't ever come into contact with each other. And generally, I think that's probably almost always the way that the basic birth control methods work. But if you look at the research, you can see that it could be possible that a sperm could make it to the egg. However unlikely, it could. And therefore, it's still not going to implant in the lining of the uterus. It's going to go on out. And that to me is my only gray area, because I have a problem after the fertilization process. Now, that's things we have to decide on our own, I believe. But there's a big difference between that and other birth control methods, what people call birth control methods, such as RU486, you've heard of that. Which is basically these things are not, they call them birth control methods, but what they're called is abortifacients, is what they are. And the RU486 is a much, I mean, people don't really have, I don't think people would have would consider using this. This is basically an abortion pill, which you take much later on, and that allows the fertilized egg to not embed in the uterus. It won't allow it to embed. But there are other birth control pills, the morning after pills, with terrible names such as Prevent, and the worst one, Plan B. These are the names of some of these birth controls. And these birth control pills are made so that the fertilized egg will not embed in the uterus lining. And I think there's a big dividing line there. I think when we're talking about some of these things which we're taking after, the morning after, so that the fertilized egg won't embed, then I think we have probably some problems. Now that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. I want us, you all have to make your own decisions on life, judged from the scriptures. But I think there is kind of a dividing line there that I thought I'd just throw out there and mention. But in the end, and I've said this 100 times, I'm not going to go before God with you. This church of Christ that meets at Pleasant Hill is not going to be together presenting our one united case before God. Romans 14:12 clearly says, you each and I am going to make an account for myself. The reason I'm here is because I agree with a lot of you. That's why I'm here. If I didn't agree with a lot of you, I would try to find somewhere else where I need to worship. But I tend to agree with almost everything here. And so that's why I'm here. And I think that's why you're here. But in the end, we make an account for ourselves. And so on these issues, I want to give you some scriptures to consider some of these things. But in the end, it's going to be your decision. I'd like to end with 1 John chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. How great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. God gives us the opportunity to follow Him. God gives us the opportunity to choose life. Who is life? Who said He was life? Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I saw a wonderful billboard that says, life. What a wonderful choice. How true that is. Let's choose life. Let's choose Jesus. Choose life. We ask that you answer His call this morning as we stand and sing the invitation song.